This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. And so it's Friday. Once again, time for our weekly news roundtable. You know, back when the legislature was in session, we were working overtime to keep up with all the news and try to analyze the stories. And of course, there's still a lot of follow-up to be done. But with the lawmakers out of the State House, the tone and tempo of the news has changed. So this week, we decided not to dictate an agenda based on headlines. Instead, we assembled a diverse panel to talk about issues on their minds. We'll take a deep look into the topics, explore the relationships that emerge. Marsha Gordon's an associate professor of film studies at North Carolina State University. Omid Safi is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Stuart Pym is a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University's Nichols School of Environment. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Good to be here.
It's great to be back.
Stuart Pym, I want to start with you and the Olinguito, which was tell us the story about how we've come to know this animal who's been abroad for quite a while.
This is an animal that's new to science. It's the newest carnivore in 35 years, and it is just drop-dead gorgeous. It has this beautiful little face. And we have a picture of its baby, which is, you know, even more so. And the story is that my good friend and colleague, Dr. Roland Kays from the Natural History Museum in Raleigh, showed me a specimen of this and said he was pretty sure it was going to be a new species. I asked him where it came from, and he said the Western Andes. I run a small nonprofit called Saving Species, where we sell carbon indulgences. We offset your carbon sin for all the emissions you put out, and we buy degraded land in places that are rich in species. We restore them, we soak up carbon, and we save species. And so I asked my colleagues out in the Western Andes to keep an eye open for this species, and they found it, photographed it, found the baby. And so we're playing a very active part in trying to keep this new species alive and well.
I love the idea, by the way, of sins of emission. Let me just say that. But beyond that, let's talk about the idea that it's because of conservation efforts, habitat preservation, that we were able to identify this species and move forward. Tell us more about your nonprofit, because it's not only habitat preservation, but also culture preservation. And you have a project in Ecuador that's very interesting.
You know, we see a lot of bad things happening in the environment, but there's a lot of things that we can do. And what we try to do is to look at areas that are degraded and restore them. And we try to work wherever we can with indigenous peoples and work with them to give them an alternative future, one that they're entirely happy with, but one that doesn't involve the loss of their cultural heritage and their biological heritage. And the group that we're working with in Ecuador are called the Huarani. They are famously fierce people. They go around with spears, and they're not for ornament. And they live in one of the most spectacularly rich, biologically rich parts of the world. And they also live on what has been estimated in terms of tens of billions of barrels of oil. And the news this week is the Ecuadorian government is deciding that it's going to go and drill for oil where these people live. And a lot of people have said, well, this is a shame and this is very unfortunate and all these species at risk. That's true, but I'm very concerned about our Huarani friends whose traditional lifestyles, they live traditional lifestyles by choice. Those traditional lifestyles are going to be devastated by this oil exploration. So it's not just about the environment. It's a massive human rights issue.
Those issues and the fact that that their lifestyle is threatened is because ecosystems are very large and interconnected. And if you take away one piece, even if it might be miles and miles away from the center of their culture, it's going to have a devastating impact on the way they live their lives.
What tends to happen is when you build oil roads, when you build roads into places, that fragments the habitat. The very process that we try to reverse in the land purchases we make with Saving Species. But when you fragment the habitats, you lose the connections. And it sort of gets worse, that people flood into these areas from outside, and that leads to an enormous amount of conflict. I mean, if suddenly you found people invading your patch, invading your territory, then you wouldn't be happy. And that's when people start killing each other, And that's when you get a whole load of ills, of pollution, of conflict between different peoples. It's going to be a very messy business indeed.
We're going to leave your story right there. I want to talk to Omid Safi now and talk about what it is that was on your mind this week and the troubles in Egypt and, in fact, the March on Washington.
Yeah, so, you know, like many of our listeners, I've been paying very close attention to this momentous 50th anniversary that we have of the March on Washington. Listened to a program yesterday here as well. And I'm struck by the fact that so many of us continue to draw inspiration from the march, from the 250,000 people, overwhelmingly black, but not exclusively, men and women who participated in it. And of course, you know, charismatic figures, no more than Dr. King, but not just Dr. King. And what's been on my mind is the way in which we as a community tend to want to resist prophetic figures that call us out. Because the purpose of a prophetic figure, and I'm using that term in kind of a biblical small p kind of a sense, is they're not supposed to comfort us. They're not supposed to make us feel good. No prophet ever comes to his or her community to say, steady as she goes. Stay the course. You're doing great. God loves the way you're treating the poor and the orphans and the widow and the immigrants. They're supposed to challenge you and call you out, and they say the way that you're treating the least of these is your litmus test of how you are with God. And I think when it comes to Martin, there's a reason why we're interested in freezing him in that moment in 1963, because we don't want to look at where he goes the remaining 5 years of his life, which is, like all of us, hopefully, he continues to evolve and develop, and he begins to connect the injustice here in America to the injustice there around the world, which for him primarily meant Vietnam. But for us, it means the war on terror. It means the Middle East and North Africa, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen. And I think if Martin were with us today, and of course he is not, but that awareness, that consciousness, that prophetic tradition is, they would want us to be disturbed. They would want us to be bothered and ask the difficult questions of how are we treating the least of these, not just in the United States, but around the world.
You know, and it's interesting that he remained among us as long as he was talking about let's all get together and live together. But the minute he said, your privilege, America, rests on the abuse of people abroad, and you may have to give up some of your privilege, America, in order to stop that abuse abroad, that's when he stopped being among us.
That's right. And, you know, when we go back and take a look at the beginning of his life, when he's participating in forming the SCLC, they say that their mission is to save the soul of America. And 10 years later, when he's standing in Riverside Church, he says, America is in a state of spiritual atrophy and disease. And if we die and there's an autopsy performed, that autopsy will come back marked Vietnam. And so the difficult question that I think we ought to be asking ourselves is, if in 1967, Martin says, the reason that we don't have food and housing and education is because we are throwing our resources down what he called this demonic suction tube, which is the war machinery. And if in 1967 he called America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, what does that prophetic consciousness tell us today when we're spending more on our military than the next 12 countries combined?
Because we depend on resources like the oil in Ecuador to destroy and disturb other people's environments in order to preserve our privilege.
Absolutely.
I want to ask Marcia now to talk about the topic that's interesting to you, which is the security leaks. Talk about prophetic.
Yes, absolutely.
Wanting to hear the bad news.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think we have to think a little bit about George Orwell and 1984 and that kind of propheticness. The story I've been fascinated by, the New York Times on Sunday published a very long and amazing piece on Laura Poitras, the documentary filmmaker who's working on a film right now about surveillance. And she's been working closely with Glenn Greenwald, a reporter for the London Guardian, who's been covering the U.S. National Security Agency, whose partner, by the way, just this past Sunday was detained and interrogated for 9 hours at Heathrow, and which was justified under anti-terrorism legislation. But both Poitras and Greenwald were contacted by Edward Snowden, which is how they have ended up in the spotlight here, the 29-year-old computer specialist who's now known as the NSA whistleblower, who was leaking documents about the government's widespread surveillance initiatives. And they actually flew to meet Snowden in Hong Kong in June, and Laura filmed him as part of this documentary that she's working on, and you know, it streams at the Guardian website. But what the issue is that ever since Laura started working on this and her other documentary projects, which is again part of this larger project about life post 9/11, her mobility and her freedom has been severely limited. Every time she flies into this country, she is interrogated and detained. Her hard drives have been confiscated, cell phone information, and she has really been unable to get answers as to why. It's this, under the Patriot Act, we have this kind of suspension of what we think of as these basic civil liberties and maybe things that are 14th Amendment and 4th Amendment related that just kind of disappear in this kind of new world order that we're living in. And so the questions that they are trying to raise, and certainly the conviction of Bradley Manning this week for 35 years for his role in leaking documents to WikiLeaks, is how do we have a national conversation about what we are all willing to give up in the name of our safety? And obviously privacy is the main issue here.
We're going to continue our conversation today about the news and some of the ideas and the way many of these stories are linked. Stuart Pym, a professor of conservation ecology at Duke. Marcia Gordon is associate professor of film studies at NC State. Omid Safi, professor of religious studies at North Carolina, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's the weekly news roundtable. Stuart Pym is with us, professor of conservation ecology at Duke's Nichols School. Marcia Gordon is an associate professor of film studies at North Carolina State. Omid Safi is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Talking about before we broke, Marcia, the role of Laura Poitras, a documentary filmmaker, and her connection with Edward Snowden.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that I just kind of want to read this quote from the New York Times piece, because one of the frustrations that Laura has had is trying to understand, I mean, what has she done? She's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker, and she has been exploring these very thorny and complicated questions. And she says, you know, when did that universe begin that people are put on a list and are never told and are stopped for 6 years? I have no idea why they did it. It's the complete suspension of due process. I've been told nothing, I've been asked nothing, and I've done nothing. It's like Kafka. Nobody ever tells you what the accusation is. And I think the question that these people are asking us to all think about is, you know, where are the limits here? And, you know, we cannot see the future and how all of this information that is being stored, I mean, imagine the quantity of information. How is it going to be used? When is it going to be used? And what kind of guarantees do we have that it's not going to be used for a nefarious purpose?
Can we stop you?
Yeah, and I think one of the lessons that we continue to learn from the civil rights movement is the interconnected sense of justice, that we're all in this together, and the threats to justice that are happening in one corner of our community affect all of us. So I think what I'd be interested in saying is, we know that Dr. King himself and Malcolm X and all the great civil rights leader were under FBI surveillance. And today we have a situation where Bradley Manning is being sent to prison for 35 years. And the question that I'd like for us as a nation to be having is, what does it say about us if a person who exposes war crimes goes to prison for 35 years and the people who perpetuated and orchestrated those same war crimes are walking free?
Sure, I mean, I have parallel concerns with what's happening in Ecuador, because as our constant, increasingly aggressive pursuit of fossil fuels, of oil, of gas, and the rest of it increase, we are beginning to move into areas where we are doing substantial harm, into the Arctic, into the Amazon, into people's backyards with fracking. And what rights do we have versus, you know, these indigenous groups in Ecuador? And, you know, we may be very moral people, but, you know, in driving our cars, we may be committing genocide In the Amazon.
And we're not asking the fundamental questions anymore. So the question becomes, is this a national security question? Do you have a right to break the law? But what's the fundamental question? Who's gathering the information? What's it about? Why are we still dependent on fossil fuels? And should we be considering? That fundamental question gets lost in these kind of more superficial debates. But I want to listen to a little bit of the interview that was recorded. Laura Poitras, she met, actually, Edward Snowden in Hong Kong, and a Guardian reporter, I think, Glenn Greenwald, is asking Edward Snowden if the government is spying on everyday Americans.
Talk a little bit about how the American surveillance state actually functions. Does it target the actions of Americans?
NSA and the intelligence community in general is focused on getting intelligence wherever it can, by any means possible, that it believes on the grounds of sort of a self-certification that they serve the national interest. Originally, we saw that focus very narrowly tailored as foreign intelligence gathered overseas. Now, increasingly, we see that it's happening domestically. And to do that, the NSA specifically, targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default.
Well, let's talk about that argument itself, the national security issue. Does the government have a right to keep secrets? We're living in a dangerous world. Maybe they're doing the right thing and we should just back off a little bit. And they're protecting us, after all. Maybe we need to give up a little bit.
Well, I think part of the problem that's being raised here, certainly by Poitras and Greenwald, is this is happening, you know, all beyond the powers of the people. I mean, this is not a we the people conversation that's being had. This is people up on high making decisions about who gets to have any kind of privacy and who does not. And, you know, I think everyone wants to live in a safe society. But if these powers are unchecked, where will they lead? And again, I think that idea of we can't know now, you know, what this information is going to be used for. We can look back, you know, in history and look at things like, you know, the McCarthy era, for example, and see how people's private lives and political affiliations were used to ruin lives and careers. And we don't look very highly on that now. So are we going to look back at this time as a time where we gave up certain things that we really regretted doing because, you know, it has a sad ending instead of a happy ending?
Well, let me ask Stuart Pym, because there's a question in Ecuador about this very question. Who is being asked and who's in the conversation? Last poll showed 74-75% of the Ecuadorian people don't want oil exploration. That's a pretty clear message from the people.
Absolutely. I mean, and within the Yasuni area, there are groups of people that go by this appalling acronym, which is uncontacted people living in voluntary isolation. These are people with whom we have not made contact yet. I mean, we know they're out there. I've traveled through some of their areas. It's a very scary thing to do. We know they're out there. They get occasional glimpses of these people. Those people are not being asked because we can't ask them. And then the people who are living in traditional villages are being told, you don't have a say in what happens. One of the worst mornings of my life was in the oil ministry in the capital of Ecuador, with a very junior person literally wagging her finger at the group of Guarani leaders with whom I was visiting. And she was basically treating these people like little children. You know, we understand what's going on. We know what's going on. We know what's best for you. And you just be quiet and we're going to come in and destroy your homes. And that's sort of what's happening with these wiretaps. You know, somebody is saying, you know, we know better. It's okay. Trust us. It's going to be all right. And you know what? We're not convinced.
We're all being colonized in
absolutely
a way.
And I think, you know, what we're called to do is to actually connect together, to see the connection between the suffering of the Guarani people and the loss of their own self-determination, and also what's happening to the American experiment. This last week, there was a fascinating mea culpa issued by the CIA, which is not known for issuing reports that say, we did something bad. Generally, it's not part of their MO. And they said, you know what? 60 years ago, we ended up orchestrating a coup in Iran in 1953, and we overthrew a democratically elected prime minister of Iran because we wanted oil. Because this prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, had the great audacity to say, Iranian oil belongs to Iranians. And we said, no, Iranian oil belongs to us to American companies at a rate of 80-90% profit. And yes, this results in an animosity from many Iranians towards American policies. As importantly as that is the conversation about what does that say about America? If we are worth cherishing, it's because of these ideals that we're trying to realize and implement, and at the core of them is democracy and self-determination. And if our greed and craving for fossil fuels and finite natural resources is leading us to override the self-determination of other people, then we're turning into this golem-like creature that just wants the precious. And yesterday and today it's oil, and tomorrow it'll be water, and then it'll be energy, and then it'll be something after that.
Well, and if it took 60 years, that means it'll take another 20 years for the CIA to acknowledge what the Church Commission did find in the 70s was the CIA's role in overthrowing the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile.
Absolutely.
Because we didn't like the way they were going.
Right.
They were socialists, and they were succeeding, which is really bad news, because if a socialist government actually succeeds, this runs in the face of all of our American propaganda that it never could work.
And it means that then we are on the wrong side of a worldwide revolution, as Dr. King said.
And it raises the question sort of about who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. Again, if what you're exposing is criminal activity in leaking by breaking the law, then who do we put in jail? And this takes us back to, I think, a fascinating revelation just this week of tape that was recorded in 1973. These are the Nixon tapes, just released by the Nixon Library. And there's a tape of Billy Graham, who calls Richard Nixon immediately after Nixon gives his speech defending his position. He had fired Ehrlichman and Halderman. He had finally acknowledged that said the White House was involved in Watergate, but said, now it's over. I fired the guys. I didn't know anything about it. He's making excuses for some of the misstatements that he had been made that had already been proved. He made that speech. The Reverend Billy Graham calls him that night.
Reverend Billy Graham.
Hello.
President?
Yeah, hello.
I think this is your finest hour.
Well, it's nice of you, Billy.
Really, I wanted to reach through that screen and hug you. I thought you were just great. And everybody I've talked to feels the same way. And,
You know, they'll continue to slash away, so what the hell?
Well, you know, Ruth.
Excuse me the hell, but.
Well, Ruth, she thinks it's all a communist plot, left wing, and everything else.
It is. You know that.
We know it wasn't.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a very interesting timing because just a couple of weeks ago on CNN, a new documentary called Our Nixon, which was directed by Penny Lane and produced by Brian Fry, aired. And it is almost entirely archival footage and a lot of it home movie footage shot by Halderman, for example, that has been sitting at the National Archives all of these years. And it allows us to see a lot of exchanges like this behind the scenes, Nixon asking, how did I do in this speech? And it raises, in interesting ways, I think, this connection to surveillance, because in Nixon's case, so much of this surveillance was self-surveillance out of a kind of paranoia and desire to document. And, you know, of course, if he could see now how it was being used and how it was circulating, you know, he probably would not have done it, right?
Go ahead, Omid. I want to hear what you had to say.
Well, I think it also raises the question of, for those people that we look to as our religious and moral exemplars, what's our relationship to power? What's our relationship to politics? Every American president since the Second War has prayed, most of them with Billy Graham, whom individually I have respect for, but this is about the principle of the issue, and then gone on to bomb defenseless people. And I would like to think that we're going to see more and more religious people, including our leadership, that will say, no, Mr. President, I will not pray with you, but I will pray for you, because my primary loyalty is that which we were called to do in the Bible, which is to stand with the least of these, as we are told.
And it gets back to what you were saying earlier about the prophet being over and against the power structure. If you're standing side by side with power, you may have lost your prophetic voice.
Absolutely.
I want to play a second clip from this exchange between Nixon and Billy Graham that night after the speech, because I don't think anything captures the irony better than this. It's a little hard to hear, but they're talking about press coverage and press analysis of the speech in the immediate aftermath. They're trashing the press. And here you're going to hear Richard Nixon first asking what CBS did.
What CBS do? They knock it?
I felt like slashing their throats. But anyway, God be with you.
I'm speechless. The Reverend Billy Graham, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a reminder of how important the press and the media are, and I think that's part of what we're realizing today with the kind of reporting that Greenwald's been doing and The Guardian, that we need to be aware of these kinds of things that are happening behind the scenes, in order to protect our civil liberties and our rights.
Exactly so. I mean, I think we are a very decent people. I think we are broadly very moral. We are concerned about other people. And so when these things happen, you understand why the leadership doesn't want the news to get out, because it threatens what they're doing, because it shows them, as throat slashers. And so that's why openness and why people like Snowden are such a challenge, that by opening WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning, that's why these people are so appalling to the leadership, because they've been caught, with their fingers in the cookie jar, except very much worse.
And let me add, at the risk of losing all of my Facebook friends, push back against this idea of us being very moral people. The great late rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel has this beautiful line in which he says, "Few are guilty, but all are responsible." And I would like to mention that we are all responsible in this. And the litmus test for that is simply this. Look around our society, the richest nation in the history of this planet. And yet, we've got about half of us living at or near poverty. And if we go to our politicians and say, why don't we have good education? They say, because we can't afford it. Why can't we provide good healthcare for all of us? Because we can't afford it. Why can't we take care of the environment? Because we can't afford it. Why can't we take care of our elderly? Because we can't afford it. Why can't we take care of housing for people? Because we can't afford it. And yet, we've got enough money to have 2.5 million people incarcerated. We got enough money to be fighting these wars of choice with cost in the trillions. We got enough money to be killing more people than died in 9/11 in drones, by drone attacks. And we got enough money to put people in Guantanamo Bay, even though they have been cleared to be released. That is not how immoral people behave, and it's not what immoral people tolerate. And I don't think we in this country, if we want to live the true meaning of our creed, should stand for this.
Well, and I think the internet and the ability of people to take film and video with their cell phones has really changed our ability to understand these kinds of things. I'm thinking of a film that came out a couple of years ago, and it'll be interesting to see if material like this comes out of Egypt in the near future. It was called Burma Vijay, and Burma is a very closed country in terms of information getting out. And there's these citizen journalist activists who took all this very amateur camcorder footage of the monks who were trying to rise up against the military dictatorship being, crushed and killed. And they smuggled that footage out of the country, and it was put together in this documentary. And that's the only way those of us outside of that country can see those kinds of images. So I think both in terms of the leaking of information from people like Manning and from Snowden, and also in terms of kind of exposing these injustices that are happening, all over the world, including in our own country, it's very important.
I think that's a hugely important thing that's happening now. I mean, in the past, we would not have been able to say, look, this is what development does in these remote parts of the Amazon. Now, we can go there, we can take photographs, we can take video. Our friends there can take videos, charging their cell phones with little solar panels. And that brings the story home. That brings that it becomes part of the debate about what's ethical. And I'm hugely encouraged by that.
And here's the important part, that prophetic voice has to reach beyond the power structure down to us. And I think here's where Stuart Pym and Omid Safi, your ideas actually come together as a fundamentally moral people who uninformed and blindly continue to consume the resources. It's not oil companies that are extracting that oil and destroying those cultures. It's me and my car that's demanding the oil, that's telling the oil company to go get. They're not going to drill for oil if I don't want it. And that's when it comes down to my responsibility. And I suspect what you were saying about my complicity and tolerance.
Absolutely. And to insist on a leadership – that actually corresponds to those moral concerns. And here's one of the ways in which these mechanisms of surveillance and oppression are actually so connected with one another. And here's a great example. Here in North Carolina, we had these wonderful Moral Monday demonstrations. We saw them initially in Raleigh and then in Asheville. Now we're seeing some in Chicago and in Charlotte and in other places. And then the governor of this fine state stands up and says, oh, these are just outsiders, right? And then over the summer, when I was in Turkey and taking a look at the demonstrations in Gezi Park, the prime minister of Turkey stands up and says, oh, these people are just outsiders. And at some point, the citizenry, an informed and moral citizenry, has a responsibility to stand up and say, we're not outsiders. We are the people. We are the ones that you're trying to mark as outside the proper boundaries. So we are the North Carolinians. We are the Americans. We are the Egyptians. We are the human beings who are demanding to live in an interconnected world.
One of the worst flights in the world is leaving Miami at about 2 o'clock in the morning and flying an overnight special into the Amazon. And the people there on the plane are all carrying their Bibles. They've all got their lights on. They're all basically fundamentalist Christians. And you know what? I love them all, because by going there and seeing things for themselves, it's going to change the way they think about our world.
We'll end on that optimistic note. Stuart Pym, thank you so much, a professor of conservation ecology at Duke's Nichols School. Marcia Gordon, an associate professor of film studies at North Carolina State. Omid Safi, professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you both, all of you, for being on this program.
Thank you all.
Coming up, we're going to listen to the music of the Beast of the Southern Wild from the Lost Bayou Ramblers. That and more live on the State of Things. Stay tuned.